Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
He knew that Jesus had true authority, that Jesus could command things to be done and that they could be completed outside of his immediate presence. Think about the great faith that the centurion had in the word of Jesus. Jesus, all you have to do is say it, and it's true, and it will be done. He believed, and rightly so, I should say, that Jesus could heal with a word just as easily as he could heal with a touch.
A Roman soldier demonstrates such great faith and humility that amazes Jesus himself. The centurion in Capernaum calls Jesus to heal his servant, who he had legal right to simply kill, and be free from any trouble. However, Pastor David will teach the opposite attitude this centurion had. He cared for his servant. He believed the power of Jesus to heal him, even by saying a simple word. He humbly considered himself undeserving of Jesus' help. We will be inspired by this man fearing God, who marveled Jesus with his heart and attitude. Now, here's Pastor David with part one of his message, Witness of the Centurion.
We've just spent the last 2 weeks taking a look at a famous sermon that Jesus gave that's recorded in Luke chapter 6 that we call the Sermon on the Plain. We distinguish that from the sermon that's noted of Jesus in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, which we call the Sermon on the Mount. And what we speculated, or at least I speculated, was that this was basically Jesus's message as an itinerant minister, itinerant preacher, all throughout the region of Galilee. That's why they're similar, but not exactly the same. Now, this tells us something fairly fascinating about that Sermon on the Plain that we just saw in Luke chapter 6, because Luke chapter 7, verse 1 says that when he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. This would lead us to believe that the place where Jesus delivered this message was not far from Capernaum, somewhere near that place. So he comes now, not far from Capernaum. He comes into Capernaum. And again, I want your mind to kind of flash a little bit when we hear Capernaum. What's notable about Capernaum? That was Jesus's new hometown. Born in Bethlehem, raised in Nazareth, when he started his ministry, he moved to Capernaum. Again, I'll say it, if you would get a business card from Jesus, it wouldn't say Jesus Christ. You know, that's his title, Messiah. That's how the business card would read. We should do this. We should do a fanciful business card for Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth, and then title, it would say Messiah, Son of God, underneath that. That's his office, so to speak. And when it would give his address, it would say Capernaum. That's where he lived. So this was his hometown. So he entered Capernaum, and notice it says, and a certain centurion's servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. So notice we have two people involved here. First of all, we have a centurion, and then we have the servant of the centurion. Now, what do we know about a centurion? Well, we know that the centurions were sort of the backbone of the Roman army. They depended on these sort of mid-level managers to be the people who would govern or lead men in detachments of approximately 100. That's what the name centurion means, over 100. And so these men were sort of officers of a lower sort of order, but I don't know what it would answer to in today's sort of military structure. But there they are, centurions, important people in the Roman army. But there's something interesting about this. It means that he works for and is an instrument of the oppressors of Israel. I mean, this man was a representative of the Roman legions. This man was sort of the visible extension of Caesar's authority right there in Roman Judea and Galilee. When Caesar wanted to exercise his authority, he would do it through the Roman governor, who at this time was Pontius Pilate, and Pontius Pilate would do it through his officers and among those, these centurions. This was, in that sense, the centurion was a bad guy. Now, once you notice, we're not talking directly yet about the centurion. We're talking about the centurion's servant. And I've sort of turned that over in my mind. I wonder about this servant. Was he a Jewish man? Was he a Gentile? I don't know. It could have gone either way. I am supposing that he was a Gentile. I'm supposing that a Jewish man would have found it too much out of his community to work for a Roman centurion. But maybe I'm wrong on that. We don't know exactly whether the servant himself was a Jew or Gentile. But this is what we do know about the servant. What does it say? He was sick and ready to die. Now, it's very fascinating what we read about this centurion. This centurion was a devout, kind, humble man, where all at the same time he was supposedly an enemy of Israel and an instrument of Israel's oppression. And he's super concerned about his slave. Ladies and gentlemen, this is very strange in the ancient world, and you would especially think so in sort of the rough and ready world of the Roman army, that if a slave got sick, it's too bad. I'm going to lose a good worker, but what can you do? Ladies and gentlemen, under Roman law, a master had the right to kill his slave, and it was expected that a master would kill his slave if the slave started becoming more of a problem than a benefit. I mean, it was just always this constant cost-benefit analysis going on in the mind of a master. And the minute that a slave became too much of a hassle for a master, ended up costing him or being too inconvenient, he had every right to just say, well, kill him or kick him out or leave him for dead, whatever it would be. No, but this centurion was different. This centurion was a man who had a deep heart for a servant. So he approaches Jesus, but he approaches Jesus, notice it in verse 3, through intermediaries. What does verse 3 say? He sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. But I'm even more fascinated than ever about this centurion. Bad guy, but a good guy. Cares about his servant when he shouldn't care about his servant. Now, we see that he has good relationships with the Jewish elders of the synagogue in the area of Capernaum. And the centurion apparently didn't think himself worthy of a face-to-face meeting with Jesus. He didn't want to put Jesus in an awkward place. And so he says, I don't need to see Jesus myself. I'll send these elders of the Jews to go meet him on my behalf, and they'll go as my representatives. And look what the Jewish leaders said about this man. Verse 4, they said, the one for whom he should do this thing was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. Now, isn't your mind even blown more about this centurion? He loved the Jewish people. He cared about them so much that he contributed to the building of their synagogue. And you might even think that maybe he was the main contributor because he built our synagogue. Whatever it is, the feeling is that they couldn't have built that synagogue without him. By the way, if you go to Capernaum today, you can see the ruins of a synagogue that is built upon the foundation and the place of the synagogue that stood there in Jesus' day. That may very well be the very same synagogue that this Roman centurion helped build. So you think, wow, this is amazing, amazing. What a unique man this is. Now, this suggests a few things to us. It suggests that even though the text doesn't tell us this, it suggests that this Roman centurion was in the category of what we'd call a God-fearer. Does that phrase sound familiar to anybody? God-fearer is a technical term in the New Testament that means a Gentile who admires and respects and follows the Jewish religion but doesn't become circumcised. And obviously it would apply to a male. You see, in other words, the Roman centurion said, look, I'm not going to go all the way and become an actual Jew, but I know there's something there. I know there's truth there. I see the decadence of Roman society. I see the immorality of our gods. Our own gods as Romans are immoral. I see the high moral standard. I hear the beautiful teaching of Yahweh and the promise of the Messiah. My soul is attracted to that. So even though he didn't become officially a Jewish man himself, by submitting himself to circumcision and perhaps kosher eating rites and all of that. But he did say, no, I want to attach myself to this synagogue. He would be known as a God-fearer. Okay, so we're interested by this man. But look at what it says next, right there in verse 6. Then Jesus went with them. Okay, stop right there. That blows my mind. Jesus went with them. Do you see what's happening here? Okay, the elders of the Jews come and say, Jesus, there's this Roman centurion, his servant is really sick, and this is a big problem, and the Roman centurion's really sick. And what does Jesus go? Jesus goes, hot dog, I'm going to go. Now, this is fascinating to me because, ladies and gentlemen, it was strictly forbidden by Jewish custom and rabbinical tradition that a Jewish person should not enter into the home of a Gentile. You just didn't do that. You didn't do that. And so we see Jesus almost jumping at the opportunity to do this. And I'm getting excited just after this first line. And Jesus went with them. I'm thinking, Jesus, you're going to blow the doors open right here, right now. You already got under their skin when it came to the Sabbath. But what you're going to do now is even more so. Because nowhere in the Old Testament does it say, thou shalt not go into the home of a Gentile. That's not biblical law. That is rabbinic interpretation. That's the law of man being put upon the law of God. And so if Jesus would have walked into that Gentile's home, he wouldn't have broken the law of God at all, but he would have really said, shove it to their traditions. And I get kind of excited about that. Oh, yeah, Jesus, good, go do it. All right, unfortunately, that's not how the story works out. Look, verse 6. Then Jesus went with them, and when he was already not far from the house, he was almost there. The centurion sent friends to him, saying, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. Isn't that amazing? Okay, first of all, I feel a little bit cheated from the story. I wanted Jesus to go into the Gentile's house. What happens? It must have worked something like this. Jesus starts walking very deliberately toward the centurion's house, and people go on ahead of him, and pretty soon word gets, hey, Jesus is going to come to your house, and the alarm bells ring in the centurion's mind. He's such a kind, thoughtful man that he says, I don't want to put this prominent rabbi on the spot by leaving him on the threshold. I don't want him to face this dilemma of whether or not I should come into my house. I mean, he didn't know Jesus that well, did he? So he goes, I'm not going to put this man in an awkward position. No, let's go out and meet him. And so what does he do? Well, first of all, the centurion himself doesn't even go out to meet Jesus, but he sends messengers out there. It says right there, he says, he sent friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself. I am not worthy that you should come under my roof. The centurion knew that it might be a problem from this prominent rabbi to do it, so he says no. And then he says, I'm not worthy that you would come into my house. All right, I'm even more blown away by the centurion now. Check it out. The elders said he's worthy, he's deserving. They praised him for building a house of worship. They said he was deserving. But look at the response of the centurion. They said he was worthy. He said he was unworthy. They praised him for building a house of worship. He said to Jesus, don't come into my house. They said he was deserving. He felt he was undeserving. And you know what this shows me? It shows me something very powerful. Strong faith and genuine humility are entirely compatible. Look, I have known in my days some men and perhaps women of great faith. For some reason, they haven't been all that humble. Well, I don't know. But I think it's possible, and here we see it in the centurion, faith and humility are certainly not incompatible. And you know, he had the high opinion of other people, yet he had a low estimation of himself. That's a beautiful thing. I like what Spurgeon said on this. How about this? A little Spurgeon for tonight. Quote, your faith will not murder your humility. Your humility will not stab at your faith, but the two will go hand in hand to heaven like a brave brother and a fair sister. The one bold as a lion, the other as meek as a dove. The one rejoicing in Jesus, the other blushing itself. I wish just once I could write a sentence that good. I mean, it's just beautiful. But isn't that a great thought? Here they are, faith and humility together in this man. Now, I don't know what you need more of. Maybe you need more faith. Maybe you need more humility. Maybe you need both. But don't neglect one for the other. It's an important thing. Now, the demonstration of his faith was found in verse 7, where he said this, "But say the word, and my servant will be healed." The centurion fully understood that Jesus' healing power was not a magic trick that required the magician to be present at the sick person's bedside. Instead, he knew this. He knew that Jesus had true authority, that Jesus could command things to be done and that they could be completed outside of his immediate presence. Think about the great faith that the centurion had in the word of Jesus. Jesus, all you have to do is say it, and it's true, and it will be done. He believed, and rightly so, I should say, that Jesus could heal with a word just as easily as he could heal with a touch. You know, it was often Jesus' pattern to heal with a touch, was it not? But he wasn't dependent upon that. Here we find that he could heal with a word as well. And look at his logic. His logic is wonderful. In verse 8, he says, "For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me." You see, the centurion also knew about the military chain of command and how the orders of a person who's in authority are unquestioningly obeyed. And he said, "Jesus, you have this authority over creation. You have this authority over life, over the spiritual realm. You don't have to see my servant. You don't have to touch my servant. You say the word and he will be healed." Don't you like this centurion even more than ever now? All right, now, verse 9. "When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, 'I say to you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel.' And those who were sent returning to the house found the servant well who had been sick." Now, when the centurion's messengers, because remember, the centurion never had a face-to-face with Jesus. He did this through friends that he sent on his way. But when those friends were delivering the message to Jesus, I imagine a huge smile coming upon the face of Jesus. First of all, thinking, he's meeting me before I get to his house. You know, I would have entered his house if I was there, but he's showing such consideration to me. That's good. This man is good. And then he's saying, he understands that I don't have to be present there, that I'm not a magician, that I have true authority. And the smile just gets bigger and bigger on Jesus' face. And then finally, when the messengers are done talking, Jesus says these remarkable words. Well, first he doesn't say anything. He says, he marveled at him. That's in verse 9. The centurion's understanding of Jesus' spiritual authority, it made Jesus marvel. His mind was blown. His simple confidence in the ability of Jesus to merely speak something and it could be done, it showed that he was free of this sort of superstitious reliance on merely external things. Ladies and gentlemen, this was great faith and it was worthy of praise. You know this. You know, don't you? That Jesus only marveled on a few occasions. He marvels here at the great faith of the centurion. Does anybody remember another occasion on which Jesus marveled? We're told in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, verse 6, that Jesus marveled at the unbelief of his own people. Isn't that amazing? That on both ends of the scale, Jesus can be amazed, either by our unbelief or by our great faith. Matter of fact, he says this in verse 9, "I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." He looked at this Gentile centurion, or at least the messengers that he sent, This man who was a living symbol of Israel's oppression, and he thought that it was greater than any faith that he had seen among the people of Israel, he said. Oh, by the way, there's a little nugget right there in that verse. What verse is that? That's verse 9. Not even in Israel. There's a little nugget there that I think is worthy of examination. Not even in Israel. This is what I want you to understand. Israel as a political entity did not exist at the time that Jesus said that. You understand that, don't you? If you were to look at a map in that day and say, well, where's Israel? There was no Israel. There was Roman-governed Judea. There was Roman-governed Galilee. There was the grand province of Palestine. There was all of that. There was no Israel as a political entity. But you know what Jesus knew? Jesus knew that you could have Israel simply because the covenant descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived and had community and existed. And they didn't need that particular land as their own political entity to make for Israel. And this is what I'm trying to get from that. Jesus calls them Israel even without their own land. It shows that Israel had not died at all in God's estimation. Verse 10, they come back and they found the servant well who had been sick. Beautifully, the centurion's request was answered, his very unselfish request. By the way, aren't you touched by how unselfish the centurion's request was? It wasn't even for himself. But the servant was healed, and it was a beautiful answer to prayer and a testimony to the faith of this remarkable man. Next, verse 11. Now, it happened on the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of the disciples went with him and a large crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. When the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, do not weep. Now please notice this. Verse 11 says that many of his disciples were with him and a large crowd. These are the days of Jesus' popularity. So everywhere that he goes, there's big crowds following him of disciples. And when we say disciples right there, as it's given to us in verse 11, it means disciples probably in the broader sense. Sometimes the New Testament uses the word disciple to refer just to the 12, but other times it uses that word disciple to mean anybody who kind of paid attention and wanted to learn something from Jesus. So this is probably disciples in the bigger sense, and they come to this city of Nain. You see that Nain is a good distance from Capernaum. It's also a little bit south and a little bit east, I think, of Nazareth, but it's there south of Nazareth, there the village of Nain. Verse 12. A dead man's being carried out. Now, any funeral is a tragedy. It really is. I understand that for a person who has been ill a long time and has suffered under their illness for a long time, that for that particular person or for that particular situation, it may see that death comes to them as a gift. But in general, I think we must say, ladies and gentlemen, death is not a gift. Death is an enemy. That's how the Bible regards it. Death is an enemy. But here's the wonderful thing, that for those of us who are in Christ Jesus, it is a conquered enemy. And that's why we can just say this, death, where is your sting? Grave, where is your victory? But we just don't have kind of this, you know, just the circle of life kind of thing, you know, kind of this karma kind of mentality. I think, well, you know, it's all, listen, I'll tell you what, death is bad.
Well, that concludes the teaching portion of today's broadcast of Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel of Santa Barbara. Join us next time as Pastor David continues teaching verse by verse through the book of Luke. Again, you've been listening to Enduring Word, the teaching ministry of Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. You can learn a great deal about Enduring Word by visiting our website. The web address is enduringword.com. That's enduringword.com. You can listen to the rest of Pastor David's messages from the book of Luke, as well as other messages taught from God's Word right from the main menu. Simply click on Media at enduringword.com. Now, here's some important information about how you can visit Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Hi, this is Pastor David Guzik. Thanks for listening to Enduring Word. I count it a privilege to share God's Word with you every day. If you live in the Santa Barbara area or will be just passing through, I'd like to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara. We meet every Sunday morning at 9 and 11 a.m., and our midweek Bible study is every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. I'd love to meet you in person.
Thanks for that information, Pastor David. For more information, call us at 805-730-1400. That's 805-730-1400. Once again, you've been listening to Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California, a listener-supported program. Please tune in next time as Pastor David continues teaching verse by verse through the book of Luke. That's next time on Enduring Word.